It was Robert Schumann, the musician, who wrote a series of songs for children called Kinderszenen. They're very beautiful. If any of you are interested in a most wonderful interpretation of these scenes from childhood, I suggest you get the record by Horowitz. It's most remarkable. Anyway, tonight, because I've been requested to do so by a number of you, I'm going to talk about scenes from childhood. We were very, very poor when I was a small boy. Very poor. I remember one pair of pants I wore had been patched so many times that the only thing left of the original pants was the shape. I remember going to school many, many, many times with the bottoms out of my shoes, have them stuffed with newspaper, or if we were fortunate to get it, brown paper. My sister and I both labored in these situations. My father was a journeyman plumber, and before the First World War, things were pretty bad. He would earn 2 shillings and sixpence many times a week, which was the equivalent in those days of 60 cents. And half of that amount, 1 shilling and threepence, was for rent. And with the other 30 cents, God knows how she did it, my mother tried to feed the family. And one day I was talking to my father and I said, "Dad, do we belong to the true church?" "Oh yes, my son," he said, "we do." "Well," I said, "why are we so poor?" He said, "I don't know the answer to that, son." But he said, "perhaps I'm not the kind of man that could be trusted with a lot of money. And I'd sooner be a poor man with my faith than a rich one without it." But he said, "some of these days, the Lord's going to set his hand to bless our household. And never after that will we want in basket or in store." This proved to be true. There came to England about this time a bishop by the name of Roderick May from Independence, Missouri. And to us, he was a creature from another world, another, not even strata of society. It was another, there was something about him that was outstanding. And of course, when once a little money was accumulated, Father felt that he could ask Brother and Sister May to come to tea one Friday evening. We were instructed as children that before the meal that we were on no occasion to ask for a second helping of jam, and properly coached, I suppose my father felt we could get through the meal without any embarrassment. And so the good bishop and his wife came and had the meal. It was very good. And then afterwards we were bundled off to bed. And the bishop and father and mother and Sister May sat down for a visit. Well, it wasn't very long before we crept downstairs. They were wooden stairs. We knew just where each one creaked, and we knew just where to tread. And silently we crept downstairs, did my sister and I, and we sat on the floor outside the kitchen and listened to their conversation. Of all things, the bishop started talking about surplus. How it came that he talked about surplus is more than I know. Dad, I guess, had a hazy idea of what it was, but he didn't have any of it. But they had very, very great lengthy discussion on surplus, and evidently it ministered to my father. For just about that time, he had just been ordained to the office of priest, and he was very, very interested in the economic aspects of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And so, after the visit of Brother May, I decided that I would send my surplus into the church. It consisted of 2 shillings, which I had saved up over a long period of time, and which I had hoped I could use towards the purchase of a toy steam engine. This toy steam engine has been in our family for 50 years or more. And when Bishop May was talking about surplus, I knew that I had come into the world with nothing. Now I had 2 shillings, and that 2 shillings was surplus, and I wanted to be obedient to the law of God. So by dint of much effort, I obtained a 2-shilling postal order and a halfpenny stamp put on the envelope and sent it to Bishop May. It was my surplus. And the next day I came down with a flu. I learned that a flu bug doesn't know the difference between an unbaptized believer and a person who yields his surplus. This I found out, and I was very sick. Every time I thought about that steam engine, I began to have doubts as to whether or not I'd done the right thing. But as time went on, came one evening a knock at the door, and the mailman left a letter. It was addressed to me. First letter I'd ever received. And I said to my father, "Dad, why don't you open it and read it to me?" So he opened it, and out fluttered the little pink receipt for 50 cents, surplus. And if you folks want to go back to the time when they used to publish the scandal sheets in the church, when they had a list of tithe payers and what everybody paid, you have to go back to about 1914. You'll see my name listed there, A.A. Oakman, surplus 50 cents. And then Dad began to read the letter. "Dear Brother Arthur, the Lord is pleased with the sacrifice that you have made in behalf of his cause. And somehow Dad's voice changed. And it was no longer Dad speaking, but it was the voice of the Good Shepherd. Enclosed is the receipt number so-and-so for this amount, paragraph. I'm sure, as I said, that the Lord is pleased with your sacrifice. And if you will continue in this spirit, the day will come when you shall preach the gospel of Jesus Christ in many lands, far and near." So the steam engine, you see, didn't seem to be so attractive anymore after that. But it has a sequel, the story. I was in Kansas, Elkhart, and we had a family there by the name of Owens, and they kept a variety store, the like of which I had never seen before or since. it had Dickens' old curiosity shop backed off the map. The place was stacked from floor to ceiling with all kinds of knick-knacks. And Brother Owens couldn't remember all that was in there, but if you asked Sister Owens, she knew exactly where everything was. I'll guarantee you that her cortex was shaped exactly like those shelves, and she knew where everything was. And I went through the narrow passageways, looking here and looking there, right in the back of the store, down on the floor, in a cupboard by itself. You've guessed it, there was that steam engine. Exactly the same as the one that I had not purchased because I had paid my surplus. And I said, Clarence, that's an interesting little gadget you got down there. What is it? He said, well, it's a toy steam engine. I said, it is? He said, yes. Would you like to see it? I said, sure, bring it out. Well, he says, we've had it for years. No good to us. Why don't you take it along? Took the Lord 50 years to get me my steam engine, but he got it. And if you come to my home today, on the front mantelpiece, you'll see that steam engine. Simple thing perhaps, but it made a profound impression upon my life. A very profound impression. But we continued to be poor. My sister and I would go to school and come home, and we lived in a cul-de-sac, dead-end street. The name of the street was Garfield Road. Whether that had any significance or not, I don't know. But we lived on the end, the last house on the right-hand side, and we used to stand at the front gate, my sister, my mother and I, and watch for Father to come round the corner just about 150 yards away. We knew when he swung into sight whether or not he had any money in his pocket or whether he had any work because of the way he walked. We could always tell. And this happened day after day for weeks and weeks and weeks. And then one morning we were waiting for Father to come round the corner of the street. And instead of Father, there stepped into the middle of the street an elderly gentleman with a long white beard and a frock coat. And he stood in the middle of the street, took off his hat, and began to sing. It wasn't uncommon to hear people singing in the streets in England when times were hard. And of course we had some colossal examples of vocalizing. But this man's voice was clear and sweet, a tenor voice. And although some distance away we could hear the words that he sang, "Begone unbelief, my Savior is near, and for my relief will shortly appear. By prayer let me wrestle, and he will perform. With Christ in the vessel, I smile at the storm." Well, the three of us stood there, looking and listening and wondering. It was rather strange, because this was not the type of music we often heard from street singers. "Though dark be my way, since he is my guide, 'tis mine to obey, 'tis his to provide. Though cisterns be broken and creatures all fail, the word he has spoken shall surely prevail." And nearer he came. "His love in time past forbids me to think he'll leave me at last in trouble to sink. Each sweet Ebenezer I have in review confirms his good pleasure to bring me quite through." Almost he was at our gate, since all that I meet must work for my good, the bitter is sweet, the medicine food. Though painful at present, 'twill cease before long, then, oh, how pleasant the conqueror's song. And he stood in front of my mother and said to her, "Sister, do you have a crust of bread that you can spare for an old man?" And mother had two slices of bread in the house, my friend. No butter. She looked at him. She had always said it was the poor that helped the poor. And she said, "Yes, I think so." And she went into the house and wrapped the piece of bread up in a piece of newspaper and came out and gave it to him. And he said to her, "Sister, because of this sacrifice that you have made, the Lord has set his hand this day to bless your household. And from this day forth you shall never want in basket and store." Putting his arm round me, he bent down and kissed me on the cheek. And he said, "This young man shall grow to manhood and shall preach the gospel in many lands." He turned and put his arm round my sister and kissed her too. It was an amazing thing. We hardly knew what was happening, and yet it happened, because I can still feel that kiss on my cheek. And then mother said, "If you'll wait a moment, I'll get you a halfpenny so that you can get a cup of tea." A halfpenny is a half of a penny, a half penny. And she had two pennies in the house. She turned to go back in the house, came back out again, and he was gone. We didn't think, our youngsters didn't think about it. He just vanished. And mother came out and said, "Where did the old gentleman go?" We didn't know. I said, "I don't know. He just left." Who was he? I've never found out who he was. But forever after that, in our home, the subject conversation between father and mother as they sat around the little stove night after night after night was the mysterious appearance and disappearance of this heavenly messenger. And by the way, he had no sooner disappeared than my father came round the corner of the street, and we knew that he had money in his pocket. And we got to the gate, kissed mother and put his arms around us, and he said, "I've just landed a contract that will keep me in work for 6 months. And so this personage became more or less, in our imagination at least, the guardian angel. And time went on. Father continued to work. I never had to go to school anymore with holes in the bottoms of my shoes. And then the time came that Father moved to another location in town, a better home. And he was very careful about his choice of where he would move to, because he said, "I want to get a place where we can throw two rooms into one and hold meetings." And he found such a place. And mother lived there for 3 years. And in 1918, she was stricken with the influenza and died. But even in her death, ministry was performed. My sister was very ill too. The doctors were overworked. All they did was prescribe a certain remedy, and you had to go and pay for it, 1 shilling and 3 pence or 1 and 6 pence, and come home and take it if you could get home. And I was sent to the doctor's office. We call it a surgery over there. I went to the doctor's office, and while I was there, my best school chum came in, told me that his mother had just died. So as soon as I got the medicine, I ran home as fast as my legs would carry me and burst into the bedroom, not realizing what was happening. She was gasping for breath. And I said, "Mum, Skinny Allen's mother's just died." And she looked at me. She says, "Son, don't be afraid. Your mother won't die." And just like a kid, I said to her, "Well, how do you know?" And she says, "The old gentleman has just come to visit me. And he told me my sickness was not unto death, but unto life. And in a couple of hours, she passed on." Of course, you can imagine what tremendous trauma that was for me. My sister didn't know anything about it. She was delirious. But Dad was devastated. His world had come to an end. And he used to go down to the bottom of the garden where we had a gate into an alley and stand there for hours and hours and hours in the silence. And one day he went down there, and after a long vigil, and he scolded me because I insisted on staying up until he got in the house. He came home and came up to the house and sat down, and something had happened. I said to him, "Dad, what's happened?" He said, "Son, I know everything is all right now." Well, I said, "What happened?" Well, he said, "I'll tell you sometime." The days went by. Father married again. And his second family are a family of probity, usefulness, 2 registered nurses. His son, my half-brother, is a high priest and a radiologist in a hospital. My half-sister, who is in England, is a top-notch legal secretary for a large law firm in London. But I never really got to know what happened bottom of that garden until I came back to England as an apostle. Hadn't seen Father for 12 years. I was a terrible correspondent and he was worse. But I guess we understood one another. And when finally I got to Euston Railroad Depot in London to meet him, there he was, as I always remembered him. We said nothing and just said, "Hello, how are you? What should we do?" "Well," I said, "let's go ride round London on the top of a bus." So we caught the first bus that came along, which was number 7 to Shepherd's Bush. And we sat on the top of that bus, just the two of us. And for at least 30 minutes, neither of us said a word. But don't think nothing was happening. In that silence, there was an interplay of personality. In that silence, there was a give and take and a sharing one with the other that was truly precious. The fact was that I was glad to be with him and he was glad to be with me, and we didn't want to spoil it by chattering. And you know, that's true with a lot of us. We get down on our knees and we talk and talk and talk. If God loves us, don't you think he wants us to be with him just because he loves us? Don't you think it means as much to him to share himself with us as it does for us to share ourselves with him? No wonder the prophet said, "Let the solemnities of eternity rest upon your minds, for in the deeps there is knowledge profound." And so my father and I journeyed. Now I said, "Dad, the big question." He said, "What's that?" I said, "What happened at the bottom of the garden that night?" Well, he said, "I had a vision, a profound experience." He said, "I was standing in the middle of the street, and the houses and the buildings around me were rubble. There wasn't a soul in sight. Desolation was written all over the scene." And he said, "My soul was empty too. I wondered what would happen." And then he said, "The old gentleman," I knew who he meant, "came climbing over the rubble and the rubbish and came up to me. And he said to me, 'David, your world is in ruins, isn't it?'" Dad said, "Yes, it is." "Well," he said, "remember, Brother David, whatever happens or does not happen, it is always right to do right. And doing right is its own reward." And that's all that happened. But how profound. It reminded me of the experience of John Milton, who, as you know, was a great social reformer as well as a poet. And who, because he offended the king, because he was outspoken, was put into jail. His friend said to him, "John, it's foolish for you to go to jail. All you've got to do is to just to renounce this last pamphlet." John said, "I won't do it. His Majesty doesn't want to put you in jail, but he feels he has to, unless you renounce what you've written." John said, "I won't do it." They put him in jail. While he was in jail, the king died, and when the new king came to the throne, he was eventually released. And his friend said to him, "John, you've served time in jail now. Just what good did it do?" Then John answered in a word which I think is a beacon light: "God tested me. To see if I durst stand and praise be to his name, I found that I durst. God tested me to see if I durst stand and praise be to his name. I found that I durst." Another thing grew out of these experiences of mine as a lad. My father's mother was a seeric kind of a lady. And when I was very, very small, I just barely remember her. And I remember her gathered with the family around her, my father, my mother, my baby sister, and a grandfather. And she told of the experience she had of seeing the place on the earth from which the city of Enoch was taken. It was so vivid to her. I have no doubt that she had this kind of an experience. But you see, early in life, before I could say my father and my mother, the testimony of Zion was born into my soul. Why? I don't know, but it was. And I came to know that there exists beyond the veil of sight and sound and sense another larger world, a world of the spirits of just men made perfect through Jesus, the mediator of the new covenant. I know that there is a Zion. I know that holy men of old and of latter years too, because of their faith in the testimony of Jesus, have been taken to that city. And I know that even now those who abide there await the time when they shall return to the earth and claim their inheritances. They rely on the promise of their Lord that the meek shall inherit the earth. Joseph Smith was in Jackson County, Missouri, 1834, during the time of Zion's camp, the uprising of the mobs against the church. And one night he and Sidney Rigdon got into a little boat and rowed across the Missouri River from Clay to Jackson County. And after they had moored their little bark, they stepped onto the shore. They found a plowed field, took off their shoes and stockings, and trampled in the earth. Joseph said, "We did this that our feet might once more tread the goodly land." There is a relationship between men and heaven, men in heaven and the earth, which is stronger than anything you can imagine. The prophets and the heroes, the seers, the administrators, the heroes of the Nephite nation wait in anticipation of the time that they can return to the earth and claim their inheritances. This is true also of all those who have gone on before. Even from the days of Melchizedek, who was king of Salem, who was such a great high priest that he obtained peace in the city. And so great was his faith that many of his subjects were translated and caught up to heaven, to the city of Enoch, a city which God has reserved unto himself until a day of righteousness shall come. When heaven and earth shall come together and the sons of God be tried, so as by fire. And as a prelude to that ministry, as a prelude to that great restoration, occasionally there is sent from the courts of glory this one and that one to render special ministry to people whom God chooses. Not because they're better than anybody else, but because he chooses those who shall receive the ministry of those who have gone on before. My friends, we live in a great and glorious age. There is no question about it. The intelligence of man has outrun his capacity to control himself. But there is a realm which is unknown to the world, a secret realm to which all of us are connected in the inner man, for deep down within the souls of men there are mysteries and glories which none of us have ever suspected. I remember Augustine of old, who in the early 5th century said, men traverse the sea and the land to see the wonders that are afar. They climb the hills and the mountains to observe the wonders which are above. They go down into the caves of the earth to see the wonders that are there. But they pass themselves the crowning wonder by. What this church needs to do is to come alive on the inside. And if it does, it will discover within itself untold resources with which and by which and through which the kingdom of God can be built in these the last days. But no, our sight is continually outward instead of upward. Have you ever pondered why it was that Jesus went away up to heaven? Some 4 years ago, my wife and I stood on the Mount of Olives from the very spot, traditionally, from which Jesus left to return to his Father. He said, it's expedient to you, for you that I go away. What would have happened had he remained with them? Always their attention would have been out there, looking to the source and the foundation of the truth, to someone who was outside of them. And so he ascended. After he ascended, they found him inside them, closer than hands and feet, and nearer to them than breathing was he. Oh, I wish that we could discover the art of meditation, an art which this church has never considered it worthwhile to cultivate. I wish we could discover and cultivate the art of fasting, so that the physical laws which support the inward vision might be discovered by us and put into operation. So tonight, my friends, as we retire, let us think on the vision of God that is within us. Open our minds and our hearts to the influence of His Spirit. Let the solemnities of eternity rest upon our mind. And come tomorrow morning to the prayer service, the theme of which I understand is to be prayer. Not full of ourselves, but full of the revelation of God in us. You see, I have often said and repeat again that love is the discovery of oneself in the act of giving oneself. Let me say that again. Love is the act of discovering oneself as he gives himself. Christ gave himself for us, and he has discovered himself in us. He would have us give ourselves for others and discover ourselves in them. This is the way of life. This is the way of peace. And my friends, all heaven and all heaven's resources wait to bless the man who will make this kind of venture.